This is The Beat, a podcast series that keeps you in the know about the latest community policing topics facing our nation.
Hello, this is Deborah McCullough with the Cops Office. With us today is Commissioner Robert Haas and Deputy Superintendent Christine Elo from Cambridge, Massachusetts. They are here to discuss organizational changes in police departments that can not only influence the internal structure of policing, but can increase community interactions and compliance with the law. They offer procedural justice as a framework for these changes. Commissioner Haas and Deputy Superintendent Elo, welcome.
Welcome, Dr. McCullough.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Now, there has long been a disconnect between how police personnel are treated within their organization and how officers are expected to treat the public. If we consider the underlying construct of procedural justice, can or even should that paradigm exist?
I think that if we expect our officers to treat the public in a legitimate, you know, procedural justice way, we really need to model that behavior internally. From my experience, there's a lot of either, you know, poor communication about disciplinary action that comes down, non-communication where we're just not explaining to officers what was done and why it was done. And what happens then is that officers tend to make up or fill in the blanks about what they don't know, which I think reflects negatively on the administration. So the more we're communicating with officers about decisions that were made with discipline, the less likely it is that officers are going to walk away filling in the blanks. I believe that in my experience, we're making some really good decisions. I just think we can do a better job communicating those decisions down through the ranks.
And again, just following up what Deputy Elo had to say, I mean, a lot of what we've done in policing traditionally is it's always been rule-based, and oftentimes imposing rules, enforcing rules, expecting the public to adhere to rules. Oftentimes they don't understand, or they don't understand the rationale for it. And internally in a police organization, we do exactly the same thing in terms of our disciplinary codes and how we treat the members of the police department, very rule-laden in terms of, you know, you'll do this, this, and this. And really, I think what we've learned through this whole process is that the process itself is so much more important than the outcome. People understanding why things are happening, the reasons they're happening. And again, internally, I think when they understand what we're trying to accomplish and what their role and mission is, and we model the kind of behavior we want them to exhibit out on the street, I think there has to be a natural correlation in terms of what takes place internally within an organization. And also then we expect to see that in terms of how officers behave towards the public. And it's no wonder when officers are subject to a series of rules and are basically disciplined I'm predicated on those rules that you then turn around and find out that they go out on the street, and when they're enforcing traffic laws, they're enforcing the laws, especially where they have a lot of discretion, they tend to lean towards the enforcement of the rule in terms of not looking at what the overall mission, what they're trying to accomplish, and figuring what the best course of action is. I think the greater latitude we give our officers in terms of having the ability to ask questions, understand the process, and then have them replicate that kind of behavior on the street is key to how an organization survives. But I don't know how you can have the organization have one set of values or way of doing something and then say to its employees, oh, by the way, we don't want you to behave that way out on the street. So it has to be the same internally as it is externally within the organization.
Absent a triggering crisis or event, how then does a police department begin to change from this posture of legal authority to one that recognizes the values and importance of procedural justice, that sees procedural justice as a key cornerstone of the department's underlying philosophy and practice?
I really think this definitely needs to come from the top. Again, modeling behaviors. We need to have policies and procedures that are in place. I think we should be having frequent conversations with our officers about the values and importance of procedural justice. Informal conversations, they can occur at roll call. We can bring up just different scenarios that have happened on the street, not necessarily singling out one officer, but talk about, this is what happened, what do you think about that? Again, bringing in the importance of procedural justice. We could do debriefs after a complaint that happens. I understand that that is reactive, but we also do recruit training here, in-service training. I think this is a constant communication that has to take place formally and informally.
I think we experiment a lot with, and it really had to do a lot with Deputy Elo when she was in our professional standards unit, was the whole experimentation around mediation. Rather than simply taking a complaint, doing an investigation, and either clearing the officer at the end or finding the officer responsible, we're now engaging more and more often where, especially when it's not a serious offense, but where the complaint comes in and has an opportunity to talk to the officer, has an opportunity to have a voice and explains to the officer how they were made to feel and what the encounter felt like to them. And then the officer, in greater detail, explained to them what they were trying to accomplish. More times than not, we're finding officers that's that miscommunication that takes place on the street. And we also believe that because it's in that kind of threshold or that kind of form, that officers get much more in terms of learning from their past behaviors when they have the opportunity to sit and listen to how people reacted or responded to the way they were treated out on the street. So I think that's all critical. I know Deputy Eel had a great deal of experience in terms of when we started to do procedural justice training here in the department and her experiences with other departments as we brought it outside the agency. And I think it would be helpful for her to kind of just briefly describe what that reaction was when we did it here, and also the correlation we're finding between very diverse communities and more homogeneous communities. And there's a correlation, I think, that exists in that realm as well.
I totally agree. And I think that I have to start by saying quickly that we've had policies and procedures in place that talk about procedural justice and biased policing that I believe have been modeled from the top down for a number of years. So when I did bring up procedural justice and legitimacy in training, officers were sharing stories after story after story about ways that they were actually already practicing this out in the street, which is very different from when I went out to a regional police in-service academy where I don't believe that they had policies and procedures in place, and they were absolutely shocked that we had a biased policing policy that required officers to introduce themselves, tell the reason for the stop, that we actively went out to people who we've had interactions with and did assessment surveys on quality of interactions with officers. People just could not believe that this is the kind of service that we had in Cambridge. They actually accused us of soliciting complaints against officers when we tried to get feedback on how we could better do business.
I think if you look at it, there's a clear paradigm that's evolving out of policing, and I think the future direction of policing. Basically, we've always been predicated upon a legal enforcement, legal authority as being the basis for policing, and I think we're now moving into this procedural form or legitimacy form where really we drive our greatest powers is from the community believing what we're doing, supporting what we're doing, and have a belief that we're doing things for the right and proper reason. And I think that's the direction we're heading with respect to policing. And the more you rely on the legitimate authority that you gain from the community, the less need you have for the legal authority that's been granted to you by statute and by your official authorities. And I think that's kind of a good barometer in terms of measuring that balance in terms of which way is that scale tilting to. Is it tilting too far on the legal side of the things? Then I think that just basically speaks to the fact that you're going to have a lot of communities feeling oppressed and members of the community feeling that they're the target of policing, as opposed to members feeling if they're on it's heavily laid on the legitimate side, that the police really are interested in what happens in the community, has a legitimate interest in terms of making sure that we provide for a quality of life within the community. So I think you see that correlation quite a bit in terms of how that scale balances out. And I think that's a good way to kind of look at it in terms of two distinct paradigms in terms of where policing is coming from and hopefully where we're heading towards.
It seems that there is a correlation then between relying heavily on a police department's legal authority and a sense of mistrust and reluctance to cooperate with the police among neighborhoods that may be marginalized or disenfranchised from the larger community. Is this correlation then supported by what you've seen in the field?
I think that there is a distrust in some of the disenfranchised neighborhoods. At least in our community, some of our disenfranchised neighborhoods are disproportionately poor people and people of color that carry a deep-seated distrust of the police. And I think from the commissioner's point, it's really important for us to be engaged with, you know, all the different communities and understanding what particular communities need, what they want from their police, so that when we're going in there, we're enforcing laws, we're enforcing things that are important to the community, that they understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, that they're on the same page with us, so we need to have community meetings, we need to be talking to community members, finding out what's important, finding out the issues, finding out exactly, you know, if we need to go in and do particular enforcement for a particular reason, that they understand what that's going to look like. So I believe that deep-seated distrust, and I think that there's a lot that we could do through community engagement to break some of those barriers down.
There's a couple challenges, I think, that emerge in policing, and I think we can see evidence of that, of both of those here in the city of Cambridge. We have a very large immigrant population that comes from a variety of different places, and a lot of them, their first home here in the U.S. is in the city of Cambridge, and they're not used to the same type of treatment by the government and by law enforcement officials. So our challenge, quite honestly, is getting them to understand that what they may have experienced in other places does not exist here, and I think that's an ongoing process. As Christine indicated earlier, our population changes, a quarter of our population changes almost every 4 to 5 years, so it's always an ongoing dynamic process. I think the other piece, and I think that's where we're starting to see some of the issues around the whole dissent decrees that are coming out, that you have large communities that see a smaller portion of the community as being not part of the greater community and look at the police as being the enforcement tool, the enforcement arm of that community. And a lot of times the police are acting on behalf of the larger community. And when a dissent decree comes into place, then there's this question, well, you know, why are we in the soup or why are we in trouble over this when we don't see anything wrong? And again, it's not just the police that are doing this on their own, but I think the police have to be very guarded in terms of understanding that all facets of the community need to feel like that they're getting equal treatment by the police force. And we've had a lot of conversation in our community about where there are neighbors calling the police because they don't like a neighbor or for a variety of other reasons. And again, not falling into the trap of, well, just responding and then reacting to the call, but really kind of assessing what's going on and making sure that people understand why we're there and making sure that we, in fact, are treating them fairly and impartially when we deal with them or having any kind of encounter with them. And I think that's key. And I think that's a greater challenge that a lot of police departments are facing nowadays in terms of being able to navigate through a very complex society that's very diverse and very different and has different views, and also being assured that the entire community believes that the police department is acting on behalf of the entire community and not just only segments of that community.
Now, it would also seem that if the public is going to move to a place of willful compliance and cooperation with the police, there would need to be a higher understanding of how the police operate in this very complex, often difficult environment that is very dynamic and constantly shifting. Aside from attempting to win over a community one interaction at a time, what other initiatives should a police department be doing to actively engage neighborhoods to build relationships based on trust?
So this is interesting because it came out of our in-service training when we went over procedural justice and legitimacy with our officers. One of the things that the officers said is that we really need to be engaged with the community. We really need to be out there talking to them about what we're doing, how we do it, and also find out what's important to them. And we've recently put together a community engagement presentation that we've been using in a couple of different focus groups, and we're going to fold this into our Neighborhood Sergeants program that really address the complexity of policing in the city of Cambridge. In the same neighborhood, you know, same street, there's very different needs. And as the commissioner brought up earlier, you know, we'll have somebody calling the police on their neighbor because they don't know their neighbor and their kids are being loud in the street. So the police are called in to answer that call. And how do we do that effectively? So when we looked at the community engagement presentation, one of the things that we broke down is our calls for service. And we realized that 80 to 85% of our calls for service had to do with quality of life issues, noise complaints, and things of that nature, and really talking to the community about those 80 to 85% of those calls and what would be the most productive way to service them. And it is very complex when we get called to those calls. And as the commissioner pointed out, we have a 25 to 50% of our population is turned over every 5 years, and looking for ways just to educate the community about that. And we're also constantly, I think, looking for ways to engage with the community in positive ways. I think our officers, time after time after time, they're getting called to a call for service, which is a negative interaction. We need to look for opportunities to have officers engage positively with the community, whether it's if it's at a community event, at a teen center, but we need to have positive interactions, I think, as well as the calls for service.
So as a deputy who's doing these community forums, I think the thing that we learned a lot was that people really didn't appreciate what the police do overall, and I think it was an opportunity for us us to really explain what we naturally assumed that people understood what the police role was in the community and what we were trying to accomplish as we started to delve into the kinds of calls we're handling, the kinds of situations we handle, and actually play back to them a couple different scenarios so they can understand the complexities of what the officer needs to deal with and navigate through some of the situations. I think it really was remarkable in terms of just showing us that there needed to be a greater understanding of what our role is if, in fact, we're going to have better collaboration and partnership with the community. And also not misinterpret what we do in the field. A lot of times we do things for legitimate purposes, but the community misinterprets that because they don't understand what the reasons are that an officer needed to take some precautionary measures or needed to take a stance initially to assess the situation before you could engage in a conversation. Because, again, a lot of times when an officer is walking into a situation not realizing what he's entering into and has to need that moment of time to kind of assess it, the thing we're trying to get our officers to understand is that once you've made that assessment, then the posture needs to change. So if you don't see the threat any longer, we don't need to stay in that command presence through the entire encounter, that we can now basically react to the situation and really start to connect with the people that we're dealing with. So I think those community forums are really important in terms of building communities of trust. And again, different communities have different understandings and beliefs about the role of the police. And I think it's important for us not just to assume that's the same vanilla presentation over and over again, but really addressing some of the underlying concerns that each of these communities had. One of the things we found early on when we were working with the Haitian community, for example, is we actually did a six-week program really to get them to understand just the different facets of policing and what we do and how we answer calls and our role within the community. And again, being very different from what they were accustomed to, and many of these folks had come directly from Haiti to one of our housing developments, and really this is the first entree they've had with the police outside of a call for service. And I think that's when you really reach the community, is being able to have those kinds of community forums, have those discussions, answer questions, and really hear what their concerns are and make sure that that is a common understanding of what we're trying to accomplish and the fact that we really are part of trying to support them in terms of their legitimate needs within the community as well.
Looking at police organizations then, police organizations have an internal disciplinary system that tends to be punitive in nature. If an officer violates a rule, then there is some form of disciplinary action imposed which could have a counterproductive outcome. In your view, should internal disciplinary systems be changing to focus more on achieving corrective behavior and instituting changes that promote a more willful compliance with the police organization's values? And if they should, how do you see those systems being changed?
So one of the things that I ask myself when I do have a rule violation, you know, we need to have the quote-unquote punishment fit the crime. What kind of violation was it? And I also want to ask myself is, does the officer understand that there was a violation? Does the officer take any responsibility for the violation? Do they know what they did wrong? Do they know what they could do differently? So I think the first part is a conversation with the officer about the violation and just to try to gain an understanding. And I think when you have an officer who makes a rule violation and you can kind of explain what happened, the corrective action can be something like training, and I think it should be appropriately that. The problem that I have seen is that when there is a violation, when something does go wrong, when an officer doesn't take responsibility or just isn't forthcoming with what happened, I think officers who take responsibility and really learn from the rule violation, we're less likely to see that pattern of behavior continue. It's when they don't recognize that something's done wrong that they're more likely to do it again.
And I think the underlying premise of most disciplinary systems was, and I think the notion was that by having some kind of disciplinary action to a rule violation that you're going to change behavior. The problem was we were getting the wrong kind of behavioral change. You had police officers shutting down, you had police officers less engaged, you had police officers feeling like they were being victimized because their side of the story or their issues weren't being considered. I think there's an important fundamental assessment that takes place in every case we have with a complaint. Was it an intentional act or was it a mistake? If it's a mistake, there's a lot more latitude in terms of trying to get officers to understand what the mistake was, give them an opportunity to say, for example, if you could have done it over again, how would you have done it differently? And really think about that situation and use that instance as a teaching moment to make sure that they don't find themselves in the same kind of situation. I think what's key for most police departments is interacting with officers sooner rather than later, not waiting until it gets to a point where it's intolerable. And oftentimes, then it's too late to try to make an effective or positive change in terms of the officer's outcome. Our goal, quite honestly, is to make our officers prosper and really be good ambassadors of the police department. So we're all going to make mistakes along the way, and I think we acknowledge the majority of what the officers do when something goes wrong is a miscall, a mistake, a miscalculation in judgment, as opposed to intentionally doing something wrong. I think rule violations need to be reserved for those officers that basically who just intentionally violate department rules because they hurt the agency, they hurt all the members of the department, and it hurts the reputation of this agency. I think the majority of the officers that make honest mistakes, things like mediation, things like having conversation about the issue, and now resorting to a suspension or some kind of formal disciplinary action is a better way to go. So that, again, the process becomes more important than just an outcome of just issuing some kind of remedial type of document that goes in their file. And I think that's where we're making great strides in terms of getting our officers to engage more in terms of conversations. And we're actually using opportunities where officers have been accused of something and they have been cleared because they acted appropriately to sit down and have a conversation with them, not just the fact that they got these peers saying they were cleared, but understanding this is what the nature of the complaint was, there were some misunderstandings along the way, not necessarily because of what you did, but because the person really didn't understand what you were trying to accomplish, and use those as opportunities to kind of increase their ability to do things differently so they don't find themselves in that kind of situation. I think the thing that's been key for us is also trying to intervene early in a process and not wait for a pattern to become too elongated before you try to engage. You get a lot of minor violations or you get a lot of violations you can't substantiate, and a lot of times the departments will just ignore those until it gets to a point where they can finally substantiate a complaint. We don't do that. If we start to get complaints and start to see a pattern, we have an early intervention system, we engage our officers sooner, and we have a conversation with the officer to let them know that although that you've not been found responsible for rude and discourteous and you've had three or four of those in the last month, there's something going on here where you're really getting the same kind of complaint from different people. And unless all these people are colluding with one another, there's got to be some basis where people are misunderstanding your approach, and you need to think about what your approach is and what does that look like, and have that kind of conversation and get them to think about it. And I think that's where the organization starts, makes that shift, that we're basically trying to get our officers to understand that we want them to learn from past mistakes and then grow from those mistakes.
Commissioner Haas and Deputy Superintendent Elo, thank you so much for your time and expertise on this very important topic.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
The Beat was brought to you by the United States Department of Justice COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems.
The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.